The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome all of you this morning for our oral arguments, but we're especially delighted to welcome Madison East High School students. Would they please stand? Welcome to you all. You may be seated. The high school students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument, and if the high school students accept the invitation, we send them the briefs you have written, and the students might have done extra work on this case. They come and listen to the oral argument, and after the second oral argument, they will meet with a justice of this court to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the case. We also have with us today a very special group, and it is a group of reporters from Kids for Television program from Middleton. Would they please stand? Well, thank you for coming, and you may be seated. And we have a special guest, Aaron Wells. Is he here? Oh, there you are. Aaron Wells is a student who is off from school today, I hope, not cutting classes. And he is visiting with the court and shadowing his uncle, Justice Lewis Butler. He's thinking of being a lawyer, and so it is up to all the lawyers who appear today not to discourage him him from this career. Thank you for coming, Aaron. Let me introduce the court to you all, and I'll start with Justice Lewis Butler, who is on the far left, my far left. And seated next to him is Justice David Brasser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with you at lunch time to discuss the procedures of the court. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Hergensack. With these introductions made, I'll call the first case, 04-004, James B. Linden versus Cascade Stone Company. We have arguing for the Lindens is Mark, is it Seidel? Seidel. And then we'll have 15 minutes of Mr. Waterman, who will argue for Cascade Stone Company and West Bend Mutual. 15 minutes for Mr. Henkel will argue for Allied Construction and American Family, and then Mr. Seidel, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that correct? Okay. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. Please, the court. My name is Mark Seidel. I'm from the Wausau law firm of Seidel and Stengel. I'm here appearing this morning on behalf of the petitioners, James and Diane Linden. This is an economic loss doctrine case in which the decision of the court will clarify the rights of homeowners to remedy shoddy workmanship against subcontractors in home construction cases. The order granting the petition allowed three issues in this case. First, in determining the predominant purpose of mixed contracts in a home construction case, should the court consider the general contract or should the court consider the subcontract of the party against whom the economic loss claim is being made? Secondly, second issue, should the court should objective evidence, should an objective test be used to determine the predominant purpose of a mixed contract? And thirdly, the third issue, does the integrated systems limitation to the other property damage exception to the economic loss doctrine bar negligence claims against subcontractors who predominantly provide services? That's quite a mouthful to state as an issue. Thankfully, though, the essential facts in this case are very simple and short.
Go ahead.
Why do we have to get into, when we talk about the contract here, there was a contract. It was between the General and the Lindens. And you want us to look at the objective versus subjective, but when I read the contract, it seemed to me that I'm talking about the predominant purpose of that. What was the contract for? What was to build a home? So the home was, it was about a home that had to be built, and the general went, I mean, the contract, the contractual part of this went into what your clients were going to receive for their money. Now, they didn't receive that. I certainly admit that. And they had difficulties. And they were able to sue under warranty and collect certain things from the general, which had to do with the contract. What do you think you talk about the Court of Appeals and using the subjective. What went wrong, in your opinion?
What went wrong with the Court of Appeals decision? The very first thing that went wrong with the Court of Appeals decision is that they looked at the wrong contract. They looked at the general contract rather than the subcontract.
But why wouldn't you, I don't want to follow, just to follow through. Well, isn't this what they would do? This was a contract from your clients with a general. They never even saw the subs at all. They never dealt with them. The only individual they dealt with was this person who was going to give them a home for X number of dollars, and who had the ability, the contractor, had the ability to go after the subs, but they, your clients, had the ability to go after the general for any defects, as I read that contract, and they did so.
Yes. But now we're talking about, and I think the problem is, now we're talking about the issue of whether the homeowner can seek additional damages against the subcontractor. It isn't any different, really, than if you go into a Ford dealer and buy a Ford. You can certainly sue the Ford dealer for any defects in the Ford, but the law is very clear that privity of contract does not bar you from going after also Ford Motor Company for defects in that car or for problems that car may have.
Counselor, you can't go after the guy that, say, the wheels for the Ford are made someplace else. You think you can go after the guy that made the wheels for the Ford?
No, but I don't think that's an analogous situation here.
Why not?
Because we're looking at a service contract. I think in the Cold Springs case, this court fashioned a whole different situation with...
But that's a different question. That's a different question. The first question is which contract do you look at? After you decide which contract, then you decide if it's a service contract or a contract for a product. So I don't want to get to the second question. I want to take you back to the first question. I want you to tell me why I can't sue the guy that made defective wheels for my Ford car as well as suing Ford Motors. If I follow your theory, it seems to me
perhaps you can. I haven't thought about and analyzed that case, but perhaps you can. I think the problem, to answer the question, comes in the fact that it is totally illogical to look at the general contract and to analyze that general contract as to whether it is predominantly services or product.
But where's the stopping point? If I follow your analogy, and I want to be sure I understand it, then where's the stopping point? Right now you're looking at the folks that put on the stucco and the folks that put on the roof, and you're saying
you know, they negligently perform their tasks, so I should be able to sue them, and economic loss doctrine doesn't bar it because it's services. Well, but the first question is, why are we looking at that? And my concern, frankly, is that the Ford Motor analogy that I give you, that if I say, sure, you can sue the dealer, sure, you can sue the manufacturer, well, now can you also sue the guy that made the wheels? Well, sure. You can sue the guy that made the wheels. What about if the guy that made the widgets that go in the wheels made them incorrectly? Can you also sue the widget guy? I have a trouble finding a stopping point on all of this, frankly.
Yeah, I don't know where the stopping point is either, because there is no privity of contract bar. I mean, I think...
Why should there be a stopping point? I mean, if you can't sue them, at least Ford can bring them in.
Right, and I think the stopping point is whether you're looking at suing someone who simply supplied a product, because that we know the economic loss doctrine is going to stop you in your tracks. But here we have a situation where the general contract did not prohibit any claim against the subcontractor.
But why couldn't he, I hate to interrupt, but what the chief brought up, well, why can't some Ford sue? Well, here the general could have sued the subs. And probably did. I mean, I don't know what happened, but there's an assumption that the general is responsible for all of the defects caused by others. And that's what the contract seemed to indicate, that if there were certain warranties in that contract, that the obligation, the contractual that were contracted for between your client and the defendant here, or they can go after the subs. You're saying, well, they can, but I also can go after the subs.
Well, I think the court should start with the proposition that people are free to sue any party unless there is a rule of law or a policy against it.
So how does the general go after the subs on the basis of contract?
I don't know, because first of all, these were oral contracts, and as we know, I think from the Colton decision or a Land Weir decision, when a building contractor provides shoddy workmanship, there can be a suit both in tort and in contract. It's both a negligence and a breach of contract. But here we have a situation where there is no prohibition, either in the contract or because of the law on privity, from making a claim against the subcontractor. And my question is, why shouldn't we allow that? And furthermore, we should allow that if the policy considerations behind the economic loss doctrine would not prohibit that.
I have a basic question. And it's this. What extra money, what extra damages or different damages do you get in tort than you would get under the concept of a contract here?
Well, frankly, I don't think any, because if there's a...
Why are you here?
Pardon?
So why are you here?
The economic loss doctrine in a situation like that, actually I think the economic loss doctrine is really only important in two types of situations. Number one is where the statute of limitations on contract cases has expired. That doesn't apply here. Or the second situation is a case such as the present case where there was no contract between the Lindens and the subcontractor.
I know, but you could be third-party beneficiaries. You could come under that. You could sue the contractor, right? And you did settle with the contractor. So you should have gotten, from my perspective, and that's why I'm questioning you, you should have gotten all your damages for this bad stucco, the water leakage, et cetera, from the general contractor. So why are you here?
I agree, and I wonder why we're here also, because our complaint against Cascade Stone did allege a contract cause of action. The circuit court dismissed it for no reason at all, and the Court of Appeals refused to...
Well, that's reverse. The next question. You apparently brought a lawsuit both for contract and tort, right?
Against Cascade, yes.
And the contract one was thrown out, and then when I read the Court of Appeals decision, they didn't let you come back on that because they said, you always said it was tort, not contract. If an error was made, you caused it. Tough luck on you. I mean, that's a quick summary. Maybe I've misstated it, but that's what I thought I read.
Well, what actually happened was a decision came down called American Family versus American Girl, which basically said in an insurance contract, you can sue for breach of contract. Up until that point, I had been under the assumption, I guess everybody in the state of Wisconsin was, that insurance contracts like this do not cover breach of contract. They only cover tort. So that's why I said it in court. But then along came the trial court's decision on the economic loss doctrine, and I said, well, we're going to go to trial on our contract cause of action, and the court dismissed that.
Okay. But then is it correct for me to understand that in this particular case, whether it's a contract theory or a tort theory, your damages are the same, namely the workmanship, which has to be redone, apparently, and damages to, and I'm using here a non-technical term, other property.
Right.
That is, whether it was the plumbing, et cetera, caused by the water leakage, and that you need funds for repairs. And that would put you, one assumes, in the position you should have been in had this bargain been completed in accordance with the terms, right?
Right. I think the
so
measure.
So this is really not an economic loss doctrine case.
Oh, it's an economic loss doctrine case in the sense that the difficulty is that we weren't allowed to proceed on our contract.
Okay. That's now I think I understand the case. So you're stuck with an economic loss case when you'd really like to be in contract anyway. You just want contract damages. Why
you'd like to be in both tort and contract.
Yes.
Sure, that's belt and suspenders. But the damages, I keep pressing you on this, the damages are the same.
Yeah,
ordinarily, in an economic loss doctrine case, the reason you don't get economic loss coverage is because the damages would be more than under contract or different under contract. I mean, that's the whole point, as I understand it. All right, so that's what you want. Now, my next question is, how come you didn't get full damages from the general contractor?
Because it's a typical case where the general contractor was basically broke except for insurance coverage. And we got that. And I think...
No, you got that. You got the maximum insurance?
Yes.
Okay, so you have damages over and above. You have not been made whole, as they might say.
No, not
well, you could have sued. Did you have a suit against the general then? You had a suit against the general.
Yeah,
they settled that.
Right. But there are damages far beyond that.
Okay.
And
you want to get them. You want to collect them. Okay. Right. Justice Bradley.
25 years ago, in Wausau, Wisconsin, if there was a water in the basement case, the plaintiff would be you, and you would sue Mr. Henkel's client, the general contractor, and you would sue Wausau Insurance Companies, who had a subcontractor, and you'd sue a couple of the subs, and your total claim would be worth $15,000, and between the four of us, the general and the three subs, you'd get $2,500 each nuisance money and would all go home.
Sounds good to me.
You would sue Mark Henkel's client as the general in contract and perhaps in tort. You would sue my client, the sub, for negligence in putting on the drain tile around the house because of the floody area and the rainfall that comes and goes from the basement. And so that's the way it would happen 25 years ago. You'd sue the subs for negligence and you'd sue the generals, I think, for contract and negligence also. So what's happened? That's what you're trying to do here, isn't it? Or am I wrong?
What happened is the economic loss doctrine came along in that 25 years. I suppose that's the only thing that happened.
Okay. I'm going to ask Mr. Henkel the same question, too.
Mr. Seidel, if I might, let me get back to some areas that are of concern to me. Let's assume that we should be looking at the general contract, not the contract in regard to the subcontractors. You've taken the position that whether we look at that contract or we look at the subcontracts, that the predominant purpose is service, not a product. And I'm having some real trouble with that because it seems to me that your clients were contracting for a product, a house, a finished house. Now, how do you get to service with that approach?
Well, Your Honor, I think in my mind, a simple reading of this general contract indicates that we were not our client was not contracting for an existing home, an existing product. It's very clear under the contract they were contracting for two things, a combination of services and materials that ultimately 6 months down the line would result in a home. Let me use an analogous situation because I'm real worried about this. The courts looking at the final product. If you always look at the final product of a contract, the economic loss doctrine will preclude any tort claims whatsoever and, I believe, effectively overrule this court's decision in Cold Springs. Let me use an example. I go into my accountant to have a tax return prepared, and obviously when I go into that accountant, 99% of the purpose of that contract is to obtain that accountant's labor services expertise, and only 1% maybe is in the cost of the paper upon which my tax return is going to be printed. Now, if you look at the Court of Appeals decision in this case and apply it to that accountant situation, I can very easily see a trial court and a Court of Appeals down the line saying, well, what happened there was Mark Seidel walked in that accountant's office to buy a product. The product was called a tax return. And we're not going to go behind that and look at, well, how much of that was really services and how much was product. And going a step further, once the court decides that what I did was purchase a product, you can always say somebody purchased a product. In absolutely every mixed contract case, you can always look at the final product and say that's it, and the economic loss doctrine applies, and there'll be no tort remedies.
Counselor, but this comes out of the UCC, doesn't it, this predominant purpose test? And it's applied all the time to UCC contracts, and they don't always come up with, yes, it's a good, and therefore it's covered by the UCC. There are many cases that say, no, it's predominantly a service, and it's not under the UCC.
Well, I'm not saying that all the past cases have been that way, and you're right, they do come from the UCC. What concerns me, looking at the Court of Appeals decision in the Linden case, is I don't see why trial courts wouldn't look at that and say, well, just about every contract is a final product case.
But that isn't what the Court of Appeals said here, as I read the Court of Appeals decision. They said you look at the chief thrust or the general thrust of the contract. And when you do that, it's hard to conclude that the general thrust wasn't toward a completed product, a home, rather than the services and materials that go into it, but the completed product. And I just don't know how you get along with that. I can understand why you might argue that you don't like the language used by the Court of Appeals, but it's difficult to argue, I think, with their conclusion. Now, what's your response to that?
Well, as I say, I just believe that what the Court is really doing is looking at the final product in these mixed contract cases.
So you want us to adopt a test, as I understand it, that is very different from the test that the Court of Appeals in the past has used in regard to the predominant purpose theory. Could you explain your test a little bit for us?
Well, the test that we suggested in our brief is a test really that would require trial courts and require courts to use quantitative evidence in these cases. I don't see how you can decide a mixed contract case without considering the quantitative evidence. Now, we did
about quantitative evidence, if I might interrupt you at this point. My understanding is what you want is to look at how much is involved with materials, how much is involved dollar-wise with labor, and on that basis make the determination. Is that correct?
No, not on that basis alone. We would not argue that that should be the only evidence. We think when you're looking at the intent of the parties, you should look at all of the evidence. But I think there should be some way the courts should highly influence courts to insist that quantitative evidence is going to be considered.
Considered or literally what must be given the emphasis?
Well, we suggested a rebuttable presumption. I realize that no court in the United States has adopted that or anything close to that rebuttable presumption, but I also don't believe that we always have to rely upon California and New York courts to provide the leading edge of developing the law in the United States. But in any event, the rebuttable presumption was just a suggestion. The bothersome part here in this case is that you had a general contract which, by anybody's reading, equally used a lot of service type words and used a lot of product type words, and there was no evidence on the quantitative part of it, and yet the court granted a summary judgment determining that it is undisputed that this was a products contract.
Well, let me ask you a cold spring type question. Would it have made a difference in this case if the contract with the Lindens had been directly with Fern?
No. That would exactly track. Are you asking?
In other words, if the contract had been with Fern, I would assume you would argue that Cold Spring is on all fours and
yes,
to control this case.
Yes.
But the contract here was with Groveland, right?
Right.
All right, so, and I guess this is following up with Justice Cook's question. If the contract is with Roland for a home, how do we turn this in, and maybe that's the same trouble I'm having, how do you turn this then into a service contract a la Cold Spring?
How do we get to considering the subcontract as opposed to the general contract that you're asking?
Yeah, because as I understand it, the contract all along was with Groveland. Now, Groveland goes out and they hire Fern. Fern does the fixing of the roof and just according to the record, does it negligently. But the contract was for a home with Groveland as opposed to Cold Spring where the contract was with the electrician.
Right. I think a general construction contract, especially with homeowners, is a peculiar type of situation. And the reason I say that is there's a basic assumption in all of contract law. It's so basic, nobody ever talks about it. The basic assumption is we all get to contract. We all get to choose with whom we're going to contract. We get to choose who's going to supply us products. In a general contract situation, we don't have that choice. Typically, the general contractor comes up with the proposal. The proposal is signed. At that moment in time, he might not have in mind who he's even going to hire for subcontractors. He might have a couple of electricians in mind that he's worked with in the past, a couple of stucco applicators that he's worked with. But because the general contractor does not even know who he's going to contract with, certainly the homeowners don't know. So you can
isn't that, going back to Justice Crooks's argument and what I indicated, isn't that the point of this relationship and the reason for the division between tort and contract, that here you have solely a contractual arrangement between one person and another or one entity and another that talks about this has to be built, and that these are the costs, this is what I will spend, and you're going to end up with this product. So That's the trouble I have in getting over that in the predominant view of what both were doing. They were contracting for a home.
But in the general contractor situation, you could very definitely, and it happens all the time, have a situation where the general contractor hires some subcontractor who the homeowner doesn't even know who's going to...
That happened here.
Right. Yeah. And that subcontractor might be the most negligent subcontractor in the state of Wisconsin and commits gross negligence and $500,000 worth of economic loss. And then the homeowner makes a claim against the general contractor, and then and only then finds out that general contractor only has $100,000 worth of insurance coverage.
Now, just stop right there. Just stop. Let's talk about that. Isn't that something that's easily... I mean, when you do anything with anybody, how much insurance do you have? Are you covered? You don't go in perhaps to their... But you want to know how much insurance. Are you covered by insurance? Because if they have economic bad times, you still want the insurance coverage. Certainly in a home of $325,000, you wanted to know that they had adequate insurance. And that's easily bargainable.
Yeah, I think in the ideal world, homeowners would not only ask about insurance, they would get a copy of the policy. They would
workman's comp and all of those things.
They would have contract provisions that would guarantee that subcontractors work. I agree. In the ideal world,
that could have been bargained for.
Could have been bargained for. I agree with that. But that's not reality. And I think the decision in this case has to deal with what is going to happen in the future with the typical situation.
But okay.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Michael Waterman, representing Cascade Stone Company and the West Bend Mutual Insurance Company.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Waterman. I represent West Bend Mutual Insurance Company, which insured Cascade Stone. I don't, however, represent Cascade Stone as a party litigant. The crux of the issue is whether or not the economic loss doctrine will apply to subcontractors. I think all of the issues that Mr. Seidel had talked about eventually are going to converge on that one fundamental point. The Linden's approach looks to the individual and separate contributions of the subcontractors, whereas the respondents in this case, in the Court of Appeals and the trial court...
Let me just interrupt you. There is no contract between Cascade Stone and the Lindens. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. The concept of economic loss doctrine is we got a contract, parties follow the contract, right?
Right.
There is no contract here. I know that the whole thing is briefed on economic loss doctrine, but I want to know why the economic loss doctrine should apply when there is no contract between the parties. Now, ordinarily, if you perform a service, right, and it's negligent, it's a tort case. And the damages are the, what is the party out because of your negligence? So, assuming for the purpose of argument, your client was negligent. All they're asking is ordinary negligence damages, right?
Correct.
And if this were a contract where the Lindens contracted with Cascade without a general involved, right, that would be the same damages, right?
If we looked at that transaction in isolation.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
But I don't think that's what we have here.
Okay. Tell me what we have here and why this is economic loss and it's not just a straight court case where there is no contract. I think, and my question really goes to the point, everybody's gotten so excited about economic loss doctrine, haven't we lost the concept in this case?
Well, I think why it's structured as an economic loss case is because the plaintiffs sued Cascade in contract and in tort,
right,
although they didn't have a contract with Cascade. Then, later on, they sued West Bend Mutual and another insurer as the insurer for Cascade.
Right.
But their allegation against West Bend was specifically concerning the tort action. And that's what brings up economic loss doctrines, because with my client, West Bend, we're only dealing with that tort claim, not any of the contract claims.
And it is a tort case. There is no contract here.
But, Counselor, if we go along with the Chief's suggestion and say, well, there's no privity of contract here, so why do we deal with the economic loss doctrine, wouldn't we have to overrule our own opinion in Dannon that we issued in 1998 where there was no privity of contract and economic loss doctrine was applied?
Right. Economic loss doctrine applies even in absence of privity of contract. Right. And I believe that that would apply as well.
Counsel, I want to take then a hypothetical because, of course, when I asked the question about those thrilling days of yesteryear 25 years ago, and I didn't include you because you weren't there 25 years ago, but it was, you know, negligence, the masonry guy, the roof guy, whoever, they were negligent. Their negligence caused damage to my basement, and that's the way it is. So let me just take the facts and change them a little bit. I have a house. I'm the plaintiff. I have a general. And lo and behold, the general is my cousin. And the general is a good guy, and I think did everything he could, except he got this subcontractor that I never met to come in and do the roof or the siding or do something in the basement. And it's undisputed that the sub is negligent in my hypothetical. It's undisputed. Now, I'm the homeowner. And it's also really undisputed that that negligence caused the damage. You know, it's just no doubt about it in my hypothetical. I'm the homeowner. I don't want to sue the sub. I mean, I don't want to sue the general. He's my cousin. And really, he didn't do anything wrong. It was all the sub. And the sub caused my problems. And it was because of the sub's negligence. If he had just used the right product, I wouldn't have this $15,000 destroyed home. This is my castle. So, you know, this is my, and I was going to have a big rec room, and I was going to have games there for the kids and a pool table, and now the darn thing is useless. Now, can't I sue the sub for his negligence, which clearly caused the damages?
Regretfully, no. And the reason is this. There's a contract between the homeowner and the general, in your hypothetical, the cousin. And the courts have been very consistent in saying what is a tort liability, what is a realm of tort. Namely, tort is designed to protect the public or society as a whole from harm, from injury, whereas performance or the quality of workmanship, defects, the functioning of a house are all matters relegated and best dealt with in contract and specifically warranty. And that's how the economic loss doctrine has always broken.
What about the performance of the guy who's supposed to clean the sidewalk at the grocery store? That's performance. Am I no longer able to sue him when I slip and fall for that ice that's been there, open and obvious for quite a while because it's performance?
Well, in that hypothetical, I think it's different because we'd have potentially personal injury and a slip and fall.
Well, what's the difference between personal? If we're talking about tort, I don't think conceptually there's any difference in the analysis whether the tort is to property damage or a physical injury to a person. The analysis deals with tort, and unless I'm wrong, tell me why that breaks down to physical injury to persons as opposed to physical injury to property.
Because that is something that the law of tort is designed to protect against. Protect against individuals from slipping on a sidewalk because somebody negligently cleaned it up or negligently removed ice.
I don't know. I mean, tort, although we talk about personal injury a lot, tort applies just as much to property damage. A tort's a tort. I don't care what kind, you know.
Correct. But the tort liability and the public policy behind tort liability wasn't ever intended, in my reading of the case law, to extend to areas of workmanship, of a product functioning the way it's supposed to function, of a defect in a product. When a product injures itself or causes economic loss to itself, that is a matter left to contract. And that's my reading of the case law.
Even if there's no contract? I mean, like, you know, in my hypothetical, when I don't even know the sub, you know, there was no contract between me and the sub, I'm not suing the general.
In the housing hypothetical?
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a contract. It may not be reduced to writing, but in that hypothetical, there would be an agreement between yourself and the cousin to construct a residence. There would then be subcontracts between that cousin and other subcontractors, the plumber, HVAC.
No, but I'm suing the sub, not the general. There's no contract between me and the sub.
And on my analysis, you couldn't do that. And I think that's the meaning of it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
With my analysis, I don't believe that you'd be able to sue and tort that subcontractor. You'd be able to make a claim against the cousin for breach of the contract, failing to perform or failing to provide what was agreed to. And then the cousin would, in turn, I would expect, bring in the subcontractor that's ultimately responsible. And I think if this case had played out the way that a lot of these construction cases play out, the general is sued by the property owner, the general then brings in the subcontractors, and then through the $2,500 divvying up the damages or whatever the case may be, the property owner is compensated in that way. But what happened in this case is that the property owners elected to settle with the general contractor for just the policy limits. They didn't have to settle. They could have maintained their action against that general contractor for an excess verdict. They could have brought in the subs, or the general contractor could have brought in the subs in an attempt to try to elicit more settlement funds. But that wasn't done. The plaintiff made a decision to settle just with the general contractor. And then in that settlement agreement, got a covenant from the general that he wouldn't then in turn sue those subcontractors to try to get reimbursement for his losses. So the situation that the plaintiffs complain about in terms of not being able to pursue the subcontractors is largely a product of their creation.
You're going in under, I gather, the integrated systems doctrine. Is that that you're saying this is all integrated into the final product, the home, therefore no tort or contract? Is that your...
Correct. And I think, I think that occurs in two situations. Number one, if we were to follow the approach that the Lindens are suggesting, that we examine the subcontracts, not the homeowner's contract but the general, then the integrated systems test is going to be virtually a nullity. Because now we're picking apart the contract, we're picking apart individual and separate contributions and examining what these people did, irrespective of the fact that that work or that product may have been incorporated into a larger product as a whole.
What did the plaintiffs do wrong here, then, in attempting to maximize their recovery? They should not have settled with the general contractor?
With the benefit of hindsight, I think that we can say that had the general stayed in the lawsuit and not settled out before these subs got brought in, or I think the subs were brought in right about the same time that the settlement was negotiated. If they had not done that, then they perhaps would have been able to elicit the general contractor to make a claim against the subs in contract and been able to produce a larger settlement pool. And that's the way a lot of these construction cases end up getting resolved, at least in my experience. But what the plaintiffs did is they elected to settle out exclusively with the general. And that general was the only person that had the contractual ability to go after those subcontractors to get reimbursement for whatever problems those subcontractors individually caused. There's some fundamental problems, I believe, with the plaintiffs going after the subcontractors separately. Number one is they negotiated a warranty with the general contractor for 2 years on defects, 5 years on the mechanical. And in essence, the general contractor was saying that he would repair or fix anything that's wrong with the house during that warranty period. By now pursuing the subcontractors, the entire responsibility for the performance of this house rests only on the subcontractors. The general contractor was able to limit his exposure to the plaintiffs, but the subcontractors are now going to have to absorb all economic responsibility for making sure that this house performs the way that the plaintiffs expect it to.
Why would that be? I mean, in a case, if it's truly a tort case against the sub, Was the sub negligent? Yes? If so, what percentage of negligence? You can have others named on the verdict with regard to percentage of negligence, even if they're not a party.
Right. We're going to run into issues concerning the comparison and also joint several liability. Is the stucco manufacturer, the stucco subcontractor now going to be responsible for defects caused by the roofer?
My comment was to suggest that maybe the sub isn't on the hook for all. The sub is on the hook for what percentage of negligence do you allocate to the sub. That's what I was saying, but maybe I'm wrong on that, counsel.
Well, but if it's a tort case, joint set of liability is available to the plaintiffs. And there's no telling that the one particular stucco subcontractor or roofing subcontractor or somebody else is going to be responsible for the entire verdict, when perhaps they only contracted for or promised to provide limited products or services. They may not have contracted with the general contractor to provide everything that they're being sued for or claimed to be negligent for. Another important issue that wasn't addressed in the briefs but is I think is important to mention is that the plaintiffs have the ability to make contractual arrangements with the general to allocate risk. They can also purchase warranties, essentially an aftermarket warranty for their house. And if they were not satisfied with the length of a 2-year warranty that the general contractor was providing, they could have gone out to a company that would provide services to basically provide an insurance policy insuring the house of defects and problems. And that is why the economic...
Why would the plaintiffs want to do that? Why wouldn't they just negotiate what they really wanted with the general contractor?
Well, they could. And
isn't that the better approach?
The better approach certainly would be to have that general contractor come back in under a better warranty or a more comprehensive warranty. But let's assume that the general contractor in this case said he was unwilling to go that far and unwilling to extend the warranty beyond 2 years. If the Lindens had truly wanted to have that extra protection for a longer period of time to make sure that the house was free of defects, they could have purchased that product from any number of home warranty insurance policies.
Well, they could have required the general to purchase it, too.
They could have done that, too. And I've seen that in other cases.
I'm not, frankly, impressed about citing Dannon or Warsaw Tile for you here. In Dannon and in Warsaw Tile, the manufacturer has a contract with the supplier. And the court says in both those cases, the manufacturer cannot sue the supplier in tort, can only sue the supplier on contract. But that's not this case. That would be between the general contractor and your client. Then it would fit with Dannon. But this case, the plaintiff does not have a contract with your client. So the integrated system cases don't fit this particular case. It would require no overruling to say, this is a tort case. Go home.
When viewing, I think the integrated systems test could be analyzed from the standpoint about whether there was damage to other property, meaning that the defective stucco caused.
That's right. I understand that. And that's the whole point. And that gets you out of economic loss. Because those cases were contract cases, basically. If you want to get out from the contract, you've got to have other property. And we have a case pending, Graham's, that raises that issue, too. Right?
Right.
But in all those cases, there was a direct contract between the plaintiff and defendant.
Yet, in Dannon, the court held that we don't need privity of contract for the economic loss doctrine to apply.
Well, it said regardless of, but there was privity there. Okay.
Yeah.
We can debate that later.
Thank you.
Thank you. And may it please the court, counsel, I am attorney Mark Hinkle from Stevens Point. I represent Richard Fern, who was the roofer on this project. American Family Insurance was his insurer. I do not represent them. Attorney David does, and I understand he concurs with my argument and will not argue separately. to add a couple of things to the material that's already been provided. The method of analysis here under attack versus that proposed by counsel is an important question that goes way beyond analysis of how we deal with home building cases. The proposal of plaintiff that we have essentially a mechanical test takes me back to the days when I was on Bascom Hill in the 70s in the law school, where early on it was explained to me that we are not an engineering school, we're in a law school. This is not mechanical, this business that we do here. And I thought about that 30-some years later when I read these briefs, and then thought back to the engineering business, microprocessors. Just came to mind. Our economy is becoming ever more complex. The things that we make, the things that we do, contain an ever larger helping of services, of intellectual property, and the value of the goods, as it were, the sand that goes into the processors, the lumber that goes into houses becomes less because we are that more sophisticated society and economy. And so the method of analysis that was used by the Court of Appeals here makes sense. We look at all of the evidence, the entire contract, and make our decision as lawyers and judges do on the basis of all of that. We cannot restrict ourselves to mathematical analysis because it don't work anymore. A microprocessor costs maybe $300. And of that, what's the silicon worth? I don't know, but not much, I suspect. What is the intellectual property worth that goes into it? Something enormous. That is our economy today. And if we are to create a rule for the analysis of contracts, this is something we need to take into account, because this will reverberate beyond the housing industry in all likelihood.
What would your test be in regard to the predominant purpose? How do we arrive at the predominant purpose?
Your Honor, I think that the rule that was used by the Court of Appeals was excellent and workable. It is apparently the traditional rule that we have learned over all the years for the analysis of contracts. And I would urge that it be continued.
What about the argument that they have, your opposing counsel makes, of course, is, look, we have objective and subjective. Now, I don't think that, well, what is your answer to that? He thinks that we should not be using a so-called subjective test as the Court of Appeals did.
Your Honor, I think that's semantics. I think that the methodology that was employed is traditional to our analysis of contracts going back for years and years. It is how we have understood to do such things. You look at, first of all, what is it these people sought to do here? What is the object? You look at the language, you look at the money, you look at all the evidence, in other words, and then draw one's conclusions based on lots of judicial experience and sound logic.
What are the subcontractors liable for, and to whom?
Your Honor, the subcontractors have contracted with the general in this case, and commonly in housing construction such as this, and they are liable to the general in a non-personal injury situation for their performance. The general, of course, is supposed to be supervising them, keeping an eye on them, shouldn't be hiring incompetent contractors anyway, so he has some responsibility. There's responsibility up and down, and if they screw up, he has a cause of action against them in contract for what it is they did that they should not have done. More practically, you can call them and tell them to get up there and fix the roof.
Counselor, do you see any difference between the Court of Appeals' decision on its determining the predominant purpose in this case and what the Court of Appeals decided in Beezy for the predominant purpose case back in 1998?
I don't think so, Your Honor. If anything, the Linden Court of Appeals' decision slightly clarified Beezy. Okay, here's how it works in this situation. We have another case, and here's how it's going to work in a construction of a house situation.
Yeah, can I follow up Justice Prosser's question for a moment? As I understand your answer, the contractor would have a cause of action against the subcontractor in contract.
Correct.
And, well, you'd never get to, all right.
Right.
I'm just trying to think in terms of the tort liability from Cold Spring, because you've got a service contract between the contract and the subcontractor. So that's a Cold Spring situation.
It is potentially Cold Spring.
And potentially Cold Spring, then the subcontractor is not, or at least the contractor can recover without worrying about the economic loss doctrine. But the person who brought in the contractor is barred by the economic loss doctrine.
The person who contracts with the general contractor is only the general contract and is subject to the economic loss doctrine, because the case law teaches both ours and generally that one
contractor has a better protection than the person, than the plaintiff.
The contractor appears to have further remedies under that analysis, Your Honor.
Right.
You answered my question, I think, generally, but have the subcontractors paid anything, or is there a lawsuit between the general and the subcontractors here, or what?
The way this thing happened, it goes back years, and my client got in late in the game. And by that time, as I recall, the plaintiff had settled or was about to settle with the general. And it was not one big lawsuit. It was a succession of things happening. And we promptly brought a motion for summary judgment after a few depositions. And initially it was denied because there was a personal injury claim. The plaintiff then became aware that he could not proceed in that fashion, that he had to drop that claim, and in due course our motion was granted.
Have the subcontractors paid anything to anybody?
We have not paid, Your Honor. On that I can't comment. I don't know what other people have done.
Counsel, assume, if you will, that I'm the plaintiff. I have no contract with the sub. It's retained by the general. No contract with the sub. And the sub is negligent, no question about it. The sub's negligence caused damage to my property, no question about it, in my hypothetical. Does the sub owe a duty of ordinary care?
Not under the analysis of our law, Your Honor, in a economic loss situation.
And there's no contract here at all between me.
Correct.
Does what happened to the law that a person has a duty to exercise ordinary care to others?
The analysis of our law, and there are lots of cases now in Wisconsin and everywhere, that say that first we look at the type of loss that is being claimed. What are the damages claimed? And this will help us define whether we are in tort or contract. And if we are in an economic loss situation, then the public policy that says that we spread the loss societally does not kick in. No personal injury, et cetera, et cetera. And this is strictly a private matter that should be dealt with in contract.
Well, isn't that wiping out a property damage claim in tort? A property damage claim. I didn't get injured. I have a property damage claim. Someone was negligent, and they damaged my property, and they damaged my property to the tune of $7,324.14. That's how much the damage to my property was. They ran into my garage as they were leaving the driveway.
I would view that as a tort claim, Your Honor.
Yeah, that's right. That's economic. That's dollars and cents. That's no physical injury to person.
I would view a physical injury, somebody driving into something with a car, as traditional tort claims. A leaky roof I would view as something else, disappointed expectations. And this sort of analysis is how the case law of this state has developed now for a good many years, we look at it that way, okay, are we in tort or contract, and then we plead accordingly.
But you have a cause of action, obviously, against the person that constructed the roof.
Surely.
Yes, and that would be a they'd have to either fix the roof or compensate for getting it fixed.
The cause of action would be against the party with right. whom the owner contracted, right. which is not necessarily the roofer.
That's right.
If the item purchased is a house and it is purchased from the general, then the cause of action is against the general in contract. There is not a direct cause of action. And the answer, I think, to what is posed, and many of the justices have posed the question, well, why not? The Shipko case deals with that directly. The East River case dealt with it more or less directly. There are parties in the construction of those mammoth ships that were not contracted with the party who authorized construction of the ship. For instance, in Shipko, a German company designed some part of the ship that malfunctioned. They could not be sued, and the economic loss doctrine did apply. That's Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals Federal.
Mr. Hinkle, you indicated that in response to Justice Bradley's question that the subcontractor does not have a duty of care to the plaintiff. Under tort, does the subcontractor have a duty of care to the contractor?
Under tort, assuming tort law applies, he has a duty of care to whoever. If tort law does not apply, we're out of that analysis.
Which goes back to my earlier question, would the economic loss doctrine apply? Let's say you've got these facts, but now you take the plaintiff out and you've got the contractor going against the subcontractor for negligence in servicing the roof. And they argue cold spring that the economic loss doctrine does not apply. Can the contractor recover against the sub?
Your Honor, the contractor absolutely has a claim in contract. Whether or not cold spring is extended to the paradigm you suggest, where the economic loss doctrine applies generally to the contractual situation, I suspect is a matter of further argument on another day.
Fair answer.
The counsel clearly, just so that I am clear, anytime you have work done on your home, whether it's through a general or let's say you're doing the sidewalk, you're doing the roof, you're doing the windows, that is considered a contractual relationship you've entered into. So you have your warranty, you have your usual rights of contract that would kick in.
Correct.
All right. So there's no, I think perhaps I'm misreading some of my colleagues' questions, but they seem to think, or maybe they don't, that there are some areas that you will not be able to get compensation for. And I think that it depends on the type of work that's being done, obviously, and the relationship you have, and the economic loss doctrine, one of the concepts is that you don't mix the tort versus contract. Either you have one or you have the other.
That is correct, Your Honor, and the counsel mentioned some of the protections available. These are written contracts typically when we're building houses. The building codes nowadays, building inspections, the possibility of performance bonds, as one finds in municipal contracts, although you don't see that commonly in house building situations. And what all of this talks about really is the business of risk allocation in these generally written contracts, as was done here. What degree of risk is the homeowner and or the contractor comfortable with? This becomes an individual decision, and in the law as it has developed, this is something that is encouraged, that people should be thinking about things like this when they are making contracts. And so one selects a contractor by asking around, is this a responsible contractor? Does he build good houses? Because he is responsible ultimately for the people he hires, and his track record is important, and his financial viability is something that can be bargained for, as has been suggested, with insurance, bonds, and the like.
And suppose, as in this case, the plaintiff Linden sued the general contractor. General contractor doesn't want to involve the subs and is bankrupt and the insurance is limited. Is there any way for Linden to get at the subs?
I would think that the general, rather the homeowner, could obtain an assignment in some fashion.
Yeah, but general contract is not interested in having the assignment. They're all brothers and sisters, so they're not interested. So why is there any way of getting at the subs? I mean, this has been asked in a number of different ways. I think that Justice Butler asked it, Justice Prosser asked it. Is there any way of getting the subs?
I think there is, Your Honor. There are many people who come into court unwilling to do things that people want them to do.
So how do you do it?
Pardon?
How does Linden do it? Or anybody?
I would hesitate to second-guess counsel, but in a situation such as the court has posed, a number of unwilling parties are going to be sued. The general is going to be sued, and he will be given stark choices.
Right.
Here are the things you ought to do or must do. In bankruptcy, and I am not a bankruptcy lawyer, his assets.
Well, all I know is that we can have him dead and the estate is, there's no money, okay? How do we get at the subs?
His cause of action against the subs is an asset of him or his estate that is transferable, Your Honor, and I think that's the answer.
There's no money. I mean, we're interested in a practical solution.
Sure.
But what I hear you saying is there is no way of getting to the subs by Linden because there is no contract or there's no privity and the economic loss doctrine bars them.
I disagree, Your Honor. Okay. I hope I didn't say that.
Well, I said it, and I'm trying to.
Right. I believe that the cause of action of the general contractor is a something, a claim that can be transferable. And I am not an expert on bankruptcy, but I believe it is transferable, and I think that it is something that can be bargained by way of settlement.
Okay. But I can't do it in state court at the moment.
I think in state court, settlements like this can be worked out.
I know, but general contractor doesn't want to do that. I want to know what you do.
What does one do against a general contractor, Your Honor, who is not responsible and not cooperative? Mm-hmm. I guess one takes a large judgment against him and proceeds accordingly.
I can put it on the wall.
Ultimately, Your Honor, what 30 years of practice tells me is that things can generally be worked out in that fashion, and bankruptcy court becomes the ultimate place to resolve such things, and, you know, we're talking about far-out remedies at that point.
I understand that, and as I see it, it's a, this case is a consequence of Dannon and Wausau, where you had a commercial purchaser suing a remote manufacturer, and I'm wondering whether or not in those cases the tort damage rule would be different than a contract damage rule because they'd be have lost profits and a whole variety of things, whereas here we're dealing with it. My real question is, if I understand it, regardless of what Linden pleads and how he sets it up, court looks through that and looks to really what the issues are in the case and gives them remedies accordingly. So why are we fussing? Why can't we? You're saying we're fussing because there's no contract claim here.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay. Got it. Thank you, Mr. Henkel. This item.
About the integrated system test, because you really didn't have an opportunity to talk about that since we kind of picked at you about which contract. I want you to assume that I'm looking at the general contract. And in the Bay Breeze case, Judge Nettesheim sets out a test for when you would determine if something is part of an integrated system or not. And the test he sets out is that the item has no function apart from the building to which it is attached. So we'd look at the stucco and we'd say, stucco has no function for the buyer except as attached to the building, or the shingles in the roof have no function for the buyer except the roof. What's wrong with that test? Why shouldn't I use that test?
I don't think there's anything wrong with the test, but it doesn't apply here.
That's because you want us to look at the other contract, though, isn't it? The integrated systems test doesn't come in if we look at the subcontract because it's not integrated with anything. We're just looking at that contract.
If we look at the subcontracts of these parties, and 85% was services, they're clearly predominantly services.
Right, so we don't get into
the economic loss doctrine would not apply, and the integrated systems limitation would not even be an issue.
Okay, all of that I agree with, but I want you to look at the general contract.
Oh, the general, okay.
Yeah, and with the general contract in mind, if I were to choose that contract, is there anything wrong with Judge Nettesheim's test in Bay Breeze that I just explained to you? No function except as a part of the object to which it's attached.
I don't see any problem with the test, okay. But I don't think the test would apply.
In this case?
Yes, in this case.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
I think the question in this case, really the orientation of the questions throughout any of these issues, should be not why should we allow the Lindens to sue the subcontractors in tort, but why shouldn't we allow them? And I think the answer to that question would have to be found in some policy consideration, and there simply isn't any policy reason not to allow, whether it be economic loss doctrine policy or whether it would be any other policy. There isn't any policy consideration not to allow the Lindens to sue the subcontractors in tort. Number one, there is no contract that prohibits it. The Lindens have honored and followed the Groveland contract, and that contract does not prohibit the suit. Privity of contract, the lack of privity of contract, is not a bar. The general contractor might be underinsured, was underinsured, or broke. And there is no way that the Lindens can get any kind of a remedy against the subcontractor except in tort. And we don't believe that the subcontractors in the state of Wisconsin should get a pass on their negligence, because bear in mind, we aren't just talking about this fact situation. We're talking about situations on into the future, and the question really has to be whether subcontractors in the state of Wisconsin will ever face any liability to homeowners. I mean, after all, they don't have contracts with homeowners. There is no statute that covers the situation. The UCC does not apply.
Mr. Seidel, what you're arguing now seems to indicate that subcontractors can do what they please and they'll never have to answer to anyone. That isn't true.
Well, I don't believe that's true, because they would face subrogation claims from general contractors. I do agree.
Absolutely, and contract claims from the general contractor.
Yes.
Isn't that correct?
I agree. I agree with that, but there are many reasons why we also ought to allow homeowners to sue subcontractors, and I still get back to the basic question of why not allow it? If the contract, you know, the economic loss doctrine cases all began where there was a contract between Party A and Party B, and the problem was that contract contained limitation of damages. So the plaintiff A would try to make a tort claim against B in order to get around that contract limitation. That's where this whole thing began. And now with this case, I think we're getting way off base, because not only does the contract involved in this case not have any limitation, but there in fact is no contract with the party we're suing. And so now we're applying the economic loss doctrine to a non-contract case. That's really what we're doing. If the Court of Appeals is upheld.
If the Court of Appeals is upheld, though, isn't this court then saying that there is a reason to keep a separation between tort law and contract law, and there is a reason to encourage parties to negotiate and to allocate risks in their contracts. Isn't that what this court would be saying?
Yes, and that's exactly what the Lindens did. And that allocation of risk that the Lindens did, and most homeowners do, and most general contractors, that allocation does not include a prohibition against tort claims against the subcontractors. That's my very point. That there is, if you look at any of the economic loss doctrine policies, there's not a one of them that would prohibit this case from proceeding. As a matter of fact, I believe that if the Court of Appeals is reversed, that will encourage, for example, subcontractors to negotiate contract remedies and limitations and protections of their liability with their general contractors, because as it stands right now, if the Linden Court of Appeals decision is upheld, the subcontractors have a free ride. Man, they don't have to face any contract lawsuits. They don't face any tort lawsuits. Why should they be motivated to negotiate any limitation on contracts?
They don't have to face any contract claims. You really lost me on that one. I mean, just because this general contractor chose not to sue him does not mean there's a claim there. And if you get a judgment of $700,000 against the general, $200,000 comes out of his insurance, and he goes into bankruptcy, you can buy that claim all day in bankruptcy and go back and sue
him. I'm sorry, I misspoke. I didn't mean to say that they have an absolute protection, because they do have that possibility of a subrogation. But what your typical case is that the damages exceed the amount that you recover from the general contract, and that's why you're going after the subcontract. These kinds of cases never happen unless there's a general contractor who's either broke or is underinsured or uninsured.
But if the general contractor is broke, I just don't see how you're in any better spot if we do what you're asking us to. Because if you had gotten, say, a $700,000 judgment against the general, the insurance pays two, you've got five left, he's going to go into bankruptcy for five. You can buy the claim out of bankruptcy, and you're back here suing without having to worry about the economic loss doctrine because you're standing in the shoes of the general.
Yeah.
So I don't see how you're in a better spot if we do what you're asking us to do than you're already in.
Yeah, I think, you talk about subrogation claims. Well, if you're going to, you got to ask the question, if you're going to allow a general contractor.
I'm not talking about a subrogation claim. I'm talking about a direct action by the general contractor against the subcontractor, which is a claim that he has, which is an asset of his estate in bankruptcy.
Yeah. I still don't think it's the same as allowing a homeowner to take a direct tort action against somebody who really screwed up his house and is the real negligent party. I don't see any policy in the economic loss doctrine that would prohibit that.
I see. Okay, well.
But Damon, I just want to. Oh, I'm sorry. My time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Seidel. Thank you, Mr. Waterman, and thank you, Mr. Henkel, for your argument today on yet another economic loss doctrine case with which the court has grappled over a number of years and probably will continue to do so. That concludes our oral argument 04-0004, Linden versus Cascade Stone Company. We will take a very brief recess so that the students who are here may leave and other students may enter the courtroom.